All right, so the big let's talk about the Shockers. The Shockers are what people were talking about instantly. I think by far, and if you know of anybody who was saying, no, I'm not so sure about Kathryn Bigelow getting a Best Director nomination, I'd like to hear the name of that person, because I don't know of a single soul, including people who were mezzo-mezzo about the film or didn't like it because of the torture element. Kathryn Bigelow getting shut down this morning is a whopper, and I don't know how to... All I can figure is that enough of the hate directed this film did stick, and that it stopped people. I think that, I believe, you tell me if you feel differently, that Ben Affleck got nudged out. He didn't get turned down. He didn't get, like, we don't like you. He didn't think he did that. He just got nudged aside by the complete whopping surprise of Ben Zeitlin and particularly Michael Haneke, which nobody saw coming.
But no, they did. Michael Haneke was the one everybody was talking about. Ben Zeitlin was the one that was out of nowhere.
Okay.
Michael Haneke, as you recall, Chris Tapley, people like that were always saying, oh, Michael Haneke for the fifth slot. You know, everybody thought that he was going to get in.
Yeah.
But I don't know how many people actually had the guts to predict him for that. But let's just start really quickly with a couple of things people need to know right off the bat before you start in with the reactionary stuff.
Okay.
The Oscar ballots were turned in before the DGA announced their awards for the first time in 65 years. That meant that there was no guidepost for them to use. Sure, they could have gone by critics' awards, but, you know, to tell you the truth, filmmakers in Hollywood, they don't have a lot of respect for critics, right?
Yeah.
So they didn't have any major announcement like the DGA, which adds a lot of credibility to contenders. It's like,
I don't think so. You think that the DGA voting for Hooper, when everybody that I know in this community, and you know this is true, not every single person had some issue, except for those that were...
Wait. Just let me finish what I'm saying first before we talk about the DGA's choices.
Okay.
The DGA's choices are really irrelevant, for the most part, except for the fact that had they come out before Oscar ballots like they usually do, those five directors would have looked a lot more important all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Tom Hooper would have been taken out, and maybe Michael Haneke would have got in, right?
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But in all the years I've been doing this, the DGA pretty much sets the tone for Best Director. This year, for the first time ever, they didn't. So Oscar voters kind of did as they pleased. And what that showed was that they went with much more emotional choices than critically acclaimed choices. They went for, I just like this movie better.
Yeah.
Ben Zeitlin was showing up a lot. I was just ignoring it because I thought, oh, he's not gonna get in. But some guy shared his ballot with me, and sure enough, he had Ben Zeitlin on there. So just to say that there were freed up, the only major guild announcement you had before the Oscar ballots was the SAG Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the ripple effect there because the master, Joaquin Phoenix, was shut out of the SAGs. Well, once you see that, you're an actor, you can decide, you know what, he was good, he deserved to be in there, I'm going to put him in for Best Actor.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how the guilds can help, is they can give you a chance to decide if you want that person in or not. I think that not having the DGA is what really hurt Kathryn Bigelow, more than anything else, me personally.
But that, you just said, though, that this, the voting was done before, I mean, finished before anybody heard about the DGA.
That's why. I think that we needed the legitimacy of Bigelow and Affleck in the DGA to make Oscar voters work from that template.
Oh, okay.
Usually, in my theory, the way that it goes for me is that I always think of Oscar voters as being very lazy.
Yeah.
When I know, the ones that I know, the directors that I know, they've hardly ever seen any of the movies. Like Alexander Payne last year, he hadn't seen hardly anything before he had to vote. So they use the guild announcements as their guidepost, in a lazy way to pick, you know. But there wasn't a guidepost this year, so they had to go with the movies they'd seen. Well, everybody's seen Amore and Beasts of the Southern Wild because those movies came out really early.
Mm-hmm.
So David Poland is onto something when he says that the latecomers had a harder time getting in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 369 Academy voters and director, you'd think that they got their asses in front of Zero Dark Thirty and Les Mis and Django Unchained and Argo.
Yeah.
So It doesn't explain it all, but it could explain part of it. And then now we can talk about the other controversies that might have also affected Catherine Bigelow, if you want.
Well,
I just wanted to get the stat stuff out of the way first, because I think it makes a big difference. If you're doing something for the first time in 65 years, you can't just ignore that, you know? When you have a huge shocker like this, you can't ignore it.
Well, why did she... my theory, my belief, is that Ben Affleck was not turned down or disapproved but he was basically nudged aside, surprisingly, by Ben Zeitlin and by Michael Haneke. It just happened. It wasn't any vote of no confidence.
Well, they both were. And the reason is that they weren't, either of them, as emotionally moving as Amour and Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Okay.
Period. They aren't. So, mm-hmm. What are you going to do? You know, what would be the incentive to vote for Catherine Bigelow if her movie was just kind of like, that's a really good movie, but it didn't quite do it for me, you know? What's their motivation? Well, usually their motivation is they really like Catherine Bigelow, and they want her to get in. Well, two things happened to Catherine Bigelow on the way to these votes, and one was the controversy around torture.
Yeah.
Suddenly, if you embrace Zero Dark Thirty, you're a torture apologist, and you're advocating torture and all of that other stuff. I mean, if you start talking, for instance, any group that honors Catherine Bigelow and Zero Dark Thirty is going to be met with protesters now, you know? The other thing that happened was Kim Masters' story. It was a nasty story, I thought, planted by a publicist, which basically said that there was a weird relationship between the two of them and that basically Mark Boal was the director behind Zero Dark Thirty.
He just meant that he's not a... I got from that piece that he was a strong personality. I mean, you don't get to be into the realm that he's in after vaulting from, reporting and being a journalist of tough stories in the Middle East without being assertive. And it just meant that he wasn't sitting there like a screenwriter typically does, even if they're allowed on the set. And he was basically a very activist producer, screenwriter.
Right, but you're talking about rational thinking. You know, in this kind of situation, you have to look at irrational thinking. And irrational thinking is the key to advertising in America, and it's the key to winning the Oscar race. Mm-hmm. And Harvey Weinstein is a master at irrational thinking, manipulation. Mm-hmm. Not Harvey Weinstein necessarily, but the Weinstein Co., you know, like the... The thing for the King's Speech, some movies you feel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's like trying to sell a car to someone. This car will make you feel young and sexy.
Mm-hmm.
Rationally, you know that's not true, but irrationally, you want to buy that car.
Yeah.
So, irrationally, people are thinking, she didn't really direct that movie, Mark Boal did. So, I don't know how far that rumor got spread around town. I don't know if people were talking about it. I don't know what the hell's going on. I do know from experience that there's always a little bit of resentment in the industry from critics' darlings. We learned that during The Social Network.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like the movies that critics like because they hate the critics, because the critics trash their movies every year.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a lot against it, but I agree with you 100% that even with all of that, I'm still surprised that she wasn't nominated. You know, even given all the explanations you can come up with, it's still a bit of a shocker to me.
The understanding is that she has the visual sense, which has been refined over 30 years of filmmaking. She is a real maestro. The sheer joy and the pleasure of watching Zero Dark Thirty from an assemblage point of view, from the way it was shot, from the timing of it, everything was beautiful. And he has provided, Mark Boal has provided, the substance, the journalistic cred, the real world element that perfectly complements her gifts as a director. Why anybody would think that he really directed, that's one of the dumbest things that's ever...
I didn't say it. I'm just telling you, it was planted out there.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that...
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a genie you can't put back in the bottle. I don't know how much damage it did. The one director I talked to, a very prominent director in Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
did not like Zero Dark Thirty at all. Thought it was a bad movie. Thought that it didn't go anywhere. He never believed that this little redheaded girl could boss the CIA around
mm-hmm.
and that they would give her the look at Bin Laden's body. He just didn't believe any of it. Didn't think it was very good at all. But again, a persnickety person who didn't like Argo either thought Argo was a bad movie. And the only one of all of them that he could tolerate was Lincoln, and that he only barely liked. So it's not like it's not like you can take his taste and apply it. I'm just saying I thought it was interesting that this particular director didn't like Zero Dark Thirty, because it seems like his kind of movie to me. So I was a little shocked by that. I don't know what to say about it, except that I can understand why those other movies got in. I can't understand why Catherine Bigelow was taken.
What would you be saying to yourself if you were Ben Affleck and you probably went right into the shower and just thought about everything after this happened? What would you? I mean, this guy is well liked. Again, nobody took him out. He wasn't given. He was in.
I know.
No problem. What happened with all you guys? I was part of it. I'm not trying to exclude myself. I believe it
shocker.
Also. So what happened?
I've tried to tell you, and nobody seems to listen to me, is when you, like, for instance, Steven Spielberg getting left off the BAFTAs. Well, you can take that on its face and say, oh, the BAFTAs snubbed Steven Spielberg, but if you dig a little bit deeper, you'll find that the BAFTAs changed their voting this year for the first time ever.
Which
means that only the branches voted. Usually they do the branches vote, and then they work off a short list.
Okay.
And all the branches put down all the categories, and then they work off that short list. Well, there's a good chance Steven Spielberg would have ultimately been nominated off of that list, and that many directors in the past would have been left off if only the branches voted. We have no way of knowing any of that information. So it's the same with this year and the directors. Like, we have no idea who the Academy would pick without a DGA guide all these years. It was too easy for them to just go by what the Guild says without even seeing the movies, even.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we as predictors, even if we had the DGA, let's say the DGA was before, I think it would have influenced the Academy. I think Bigelow would have been in, at least, even if Affleck was dumped. But we still would be predicting Ben Affleck because he got a DGA award. In fact, Argo got every single Guild mention. Everyone. So it seems likely that he would have also gotten an Oscar nomination. But look, David Fincher didn't get one yet last year, and Dragon Tattoo had a DGA.
Yeah.
I would say to Ben Affleck, when Steven Spielberg was a young director, Color Purple got 10 nominations, and he didn't get one for director. So it happens, you know. This kind of weird stuff does happen. It's just rare.
I would figure I don't think that there's any way I would have taken any money, any bet. I would have taken $100, I would have taken a $200 bet that he, if someone said he's not going to make the best director, I would have taken it just like that. I wouldn't have thought about it. It's really a shocker, and I don't know that you can lay it all on the fact that the DGA wasn't known before people finished voting. I mean,
I don't think you can lay it all on that either, but I think it's a factor to consider.
Yeah.
Because the Academy was given a chance to do whatever the hell they wanted this year, as opposed to
being invited. Well, it's about as intelligent as any assessment I've thought of or read so far in the last couple of hours. So, what do you think about the what happened to all the the James Bond movie is going to get in for the first
time.
What happened?
That was a big bust. That was a bust. Well, are you talking about Best Picture for Skyfall?
Yeah, I thought maybe, you know, that's what I was starting to hear.
I did too. I thought if any movie could overcome the stigma of it being James Bond, it would be this one. But, you know, they're genre phobes. They always have been. They didn't nominate The Dark Knight, and they shut out The Dark Knight Rises. They don't like that stuff. They like it when Peter Jackson does it because it has sort of an air of respectability. But for the most part, they're not genre geeks, and Skyfall didn't do that well. I didn't think it was that good of a movie myself, so I can't be horrified by that.
But didn't it? Let me see. I'm pulling up the actual nominees themselves. But didn't it get DP for Roger Deakins? Didn't he?
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
it got that for sure, and it got 2 sound nominations. That's about where a movie like this would sit.
Okay.
It just didn't get what we all thought, which was we thought it was going to get supporting actor and picture maybe, and it would have gotten in if they were doing the 10 nominees. But with the current system, you can't get in unless you're a number one choice.
Yeah, that's right.
So have to imagine, like, your readers are some of them, not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lot of the people I know on Twitter are the type of people that would put Skyfall as their number one.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to get a lot of Academy voters that would, I don't think. So
it's a pretty big surprise. You got to admit, Sasha. I was foreseeing for Silver Linings. I thought that the Academy would not follow the lead, even though they didn't know what the lead was, of the DJ turning down David O. Russell. I felt he did too much politicking. And he's really talked and walked the walk with mm-hmm. every possible venue I can imagine. And he has a good spiel, and I think he's put to bed all the tempestuous temper tantrum thing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's all. But I would have figured De Niro for sure. I would have figured Best Picture definitely, and Russell. And that's about it. I mean, maybe
Jennifer Lawrence.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. That would be four.
There's only one surprise nomination for Silver Linings, and that's Jackie Weaver.
Yeah, that was a complete surprise. And when I saw that, that was very early in the nominee. I went, uh-oh, something's happening here. This is different. This is not expected. So.
It's actually expected for me, even though, you know, I hated the movie, didn't hate the movie, just didn't like it that much. All I've been doing is telling people that the one movie people have been talking about is Silver Linings. And the only reason I changed my prediction from David O. Russell at the last minute was that, despite that, I felt like Django Unchained was coming along and was going to steal its thunder in the director category. So I changed at the last minute to Quentin Tarantino. But I'd been predicting David O. Russell for a while. Okay. I mean, that's an actor's movie, it's a director's movie, it's a writer's movie, it's a movie people really like, you know?
Well, it went from a point of being, it had its moment in October. It's basically been marginalized, it's starting to make money now, but don't get, you know. So basically it's an outlier. It's like, you know, three or four nominations. That's it. And now it's that one. It's
I don't
Lincoln,
think anybody saw it that way. I certainly didn't. I always thought of it as a major player, always, because it's the Weinsteins.
Yeah.
If it wasn't them, I would have agreed with you. But it was always their pony, so it was always going to do well in the race.
And has Lisa Tabak done well by herself this morning, or what?
Yes. Mm-hmm. She's redeemed herself from the somewhat embarrassing moment of the DGAs where they were horrified that not a single Weinstein contender had been in there. So they've saved face. It still is the longest of long shots to win under those.
No, I understand it's probably not going to win, and I understand it's a Lincoln win. And I think we pretty much understand that. But
I'm not saying it's a Lincoln win yet. I mean, all signs look like that, but there are two other movies that could win.
Yeah.
The Silver Linings being one of them.
Yeah.
The long shot, but it could still win.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, by the way, about the category challenge that Jeff Snyder put up? He said, I challenge Christoph Waltz for supporting. He leaves Django Unchained, about a half hour before it ends or 25 minutes before it ends? But he's in the whole damn thing. I mean, it's Django Unchained, so that means Jamie Foxx is the lead. But still, that's a stretch, don't you think, to call him supporting?
Yeah, I really do. I think it's funny that they just played along like that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I think he's great in it, you know, and I think that Jamie Foxx is also great. I would like to have seen him get nominated, but...
Mm-hmm. So you don't have anything. So what about...
One of those people that gets all uptight about category fraud. I have never been that. I mean, I know that, like, Juliette Binoche winning for The English Patient and supporting was a huge stretch. Jim Broadbent won for Iris or some of those movies, and his was a lead role, too. And Jennifer Connelly in Beautiful Mind, that was a big leading role. Jennifer Lawrence, if she had been put in supporting for Silver Linings, might have won. Or she still might win, actually.
But I understand that. What am I understanding as far as Django...
But Jennifer Lawrence is a supporting character the same way Jennifer Connelly was in A Beautiful Mind. Like, she's only there really to prop up Bradley Cooper.
I think she's her own energy force field in that movie. Every time she's on screen,
she
carries the... That's what being a best actress is. That's not about...
Oh, a best actress is... Well, yes, in 2012, I agree with you, because there's no such thing as a strong leading role anymore.
Now, the whole point of Django was that it's supposed to be Leonardo DiCaprio as the venal Candyland plantation owner, and he didn't make it, and he's going up to Santa Barbara Film Festival anyway. So I thought that was going to be the supporting actor thing. You never placed any stock.
Oh God, I know, right? Because and now Ben Affleck's getting that award too.
Yeah, that's rough. But he's
Ben Affleck, and it's. But didn't they also? Who else are they honoring? It's Ben Affleck and
Jennifer Lawrence, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Okay.
And you know, the master the supporting actress,
Amy Adams. Right. Okay, so she's in.
Yeah.
So it's only Affleck and Leo that are the two out ones. But you know, I didn't think I don't know how they expected they would get Leo a nomination with that performance. You know.
Mm.
I was surprised people kept pestering me about it because a lot of his fans kept writing me, do you think Leo's going to get... No, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I'm sorry.
If you were Michael Barker and Tom Bernard at Sony Classics, would you have been saying to yourself last night, well, what do you think? Do you think Haneke might get nominated for director? I mean, I think we have a shot at Amore getting a Best Picture. I believe it. I mean, I'm hoping for it. I don't think it's unrealistic. But Haneke for Best Director, I don't know. I don't think we should.
It was also, that was a thing people were talking about early on, yeah. It's just weird to see it all play out the way a lot of people had suspected it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't buy the Amore thing. I didn't go for it. I know David Pullen and Chris Tapley and a couple other people I know did predict it to be nominated. But I thought it was too gloomy and that they wouldn't want to watch it, you know, but they did and they loved it. So
I had an evolution as I've tried to express in the column, which is that my first reaction was that I felt the taste of ashes and death in my mouth as I left it, and I remembered the experience that I went through seeing my father completely deteriorate bit by bit, organ by organ.
Mm-mm.
And I didn't want to, I thought it was horrible. I found it a kind of horror film of a very high order. But then, you know, after seeing it actually three more times, I've seen it four times now.
Jesus Christ!
I've seen it twice on a screener.
I can't even think of seeing it a second time.
And I saw it a second time with Tom O'Neill at Sony, and I felt better about it. I said, you know, this has real integrity and this has real clarity and strength as a, it's really a quite an artful film, and I'm amazed that other people felt that way immediately, because I presume most people are not obsessive like me. They probably just saw it once. I felt really like a big chill from that film. Did you not feel that way yourself, or not?
Well, like I say, I only saw it that one time in Cannes, and I was really, really impressed and deeply moved by it. I knew at the time I would never be able to sit through it again, though.
Okay.
But
when you say deeply moved, you mean you were, like, teared up?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. And what scene in particular got to you in that way? Because it's never gotten to me in that way. I just look at it as a piece of super impressive but sterile, cold, chilly art. I don't see the emotional thing.
Some people agree with you. Like, I've had debates with people about that. But to me, maybe the only heartbreaking thing about life, the only sort of unbearable aspect to it, the part that makes me sort of wish I'd never even been born, and I certainly never given birth to a child, is loving somebody so much that the thought of you dying before they do, or them dying
at all,
having to deal with that death, is so unbearable that, you know, you would have to just end your life. I mean, I feel that way about my own daughter. Like, I couldn't bear the thought of dying and leaving her to fend for herself. And if she ever got sick. And to me, this is like the first movie I've ever seen that addresses what people are willing to go through to keep somebody alive. And my sister, like, she had this dog that she raised since the time he was a puppy. And they were so close. And he was her best friend. And he started to die. And he lost his leg, and she kept him, like, immobile on three legs on the ground on painkillers because she couldn't bear to let go of him. And finally, after he died, like, she's had to live with that haunting memory all these years that she just didn't pull the plug. And she made him live in pain like that because she loved him so much and she couldn't let go of him. And same thing happened to my dad and my grandma. He couldn't let go of her. And so when it was time for her to die, he had them install a feeding tube.
Right.
And she spent the last few, you know, hours of her life, moments of her life, like, in complete misery, just with this food tube mm-hmm. stuck in her. And by then, there was no life left. But mm-hmm. to me, Amour isn't about so much love. It's about letting go and how hard that is. And it's, to me, the total brutal truth and the reality and the unbearable reality mm-hmm. of life mm-hmm. is that we are who we love and who we're connected to. And
yeah.
God help us when we have to say goodbye to that.
Well, the worst thing that any parent feels is that if their children go before they do, that's probably the most agonizing thing.
Oh, God, I can't even.
And that's something that, you know, any good parent knows, that if they've been a good parent, they've not only made the child feel loved and unconditionally loved, but that... they've given them the steel, and they made sure that they know how to fend for themselves. That's really the ultimate thing, also. And you know,
yeah.
You're a good mom. You know, your daughter is a very happening young lady. So
thanks. You know. She is. I'm so proud of her and her art and everything that she's doing. She's going on her first date tomorrow. I'm just going to lose my mind. She's got this boyfriend all of a sudden. It's her first boyfriend. It's so bizarre.
And they're going to go walking or something down to NoHo? Or?
Exactly. No, it's like, he lives on the west side, so it's like, you know, I'm going to drop her off, and they're going to watch Cloud Atlas, and then they're going to go walk around the mall. And then I'm going to pick him up. Mm. So, oh my God. It's just so funny because now that I'm old, and I've lived through life, and I've lived through many lovers and boyfriends, and mm-hmm. you know, and all that history is new for her. Like both of them, mm-hmm. two of them, and they're just starting to build what will become like the iconic templates in their life for relationships. You know,
mm-hmm.
what kind of person they'll be attracted to. You know, what kind of confidence they have in themselves as a partner to someone. You know, it's all starting now. It's just so surreal to watch.
So if you were Tony Angelotti and you're able to take yourself back 3 weeks, 4 weeks, is there anything that he could have done, or Sony could have done, or Catherine Bigelow could have done to somehow, do you think that she, because she didn't really get into the whole argument about torture, she said, you know, the movie speaks for itself, we didn't seek to make any statement about it, you know, she said one pronounced thing, which is that at the New York Film Critics Circle acceptance, you know, depiction of something is not endorsement of it.
Yeah.
That's, you know, if she had said that more forcefully, would that have made a difference? Because
I don't think so. I didn't, I think, I don't think that ultimately, like, I really honestly believe, when I think about it, the two main forces were, number one, the date change
mm-hmm.
screwed things up really badly. David Pullen's right about that.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, Zero Dark Thirty is not an emotional movie. It didn't even get a SAG ensemble, and it's true that they might not have seen the movie, but they might have seen the movie, mm-hmm. and I just think that a lot of times critics kind of, you know, get into themselves and think that the whole awards industry is based on what they think about a movie, not based on what everybody else thinks about it, necessarily. And, you know, so if you're looking at two movies side by side, Amour and Zero Dark Thirty, I don't know how you... I don't know. I can't go on the movie. Okay, so let's just forget about the movie, because mm-hmm. the movie is so good, it deserves
yeah.
to be there. So let's just not even go there. But
So Ben...
What's your thing? Okay, so let's get into it for just a quick
yeah.
second, which I know everybody's tired of hearing about it, but yeah. they're in a pile of shit, and there's no way out of it. Basically, when you have the editor of Mother Jones, David Korn,
yeah.
talking about the movie being pro-torture,
mm-hmm.
and you have, you know, Dianne Feinstein and John McCain,
mm-hmm.
both sides, and then the only people really defending the movie, there are a couple of people here, are right-wing.
The guy from The Atlantic who wrote that very eloquent and very well-reasoned piece... that Mark Boll was telling people about. It's a very well-written piece. This guy knows his stuff up and down. As an interview to Obama, you should look at that piece. I mean, that piece...
Yeah, but there are contradictory pieces to that piece by other people who are of equal importance, and there are more of them than there are defenses. I'm not saying that Zero Dark Thirty is a pro-torture movie. It isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But it tells a point in American history from a very specific point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that... point of view is up for debate. And half the people believe it went down a certain way, and half the people believe it went down a different way. But the movie doesn't ever address that. It doesn't say there were two ways of looking at this story. It just shows one way. It's like my sister was saying.
No, it does. It doesn't. When they get the real information is when they're nice to that guy, and buy him hummus and tomatoes, and you know he knows that he might go back in, but it obviously
nice. He says, I could just tie you to the ceiling again. First of all, second of all, he's just been put in a box. He's sleep deprived.
Yeah.
Every scene where they refer to the detainee, they say. The White House, this is how bad it is in Zero Dark Thirty. The only people questioning the information mm-hmm. is the Obama White House, mm-hmm. and they say this information, how can we go get Osama bin Laden? We can't even trust this information because it was obtained by a detainee under duress.
Uh-huh.
They say that.
Right.
Well, the movie confirms, of course,
mm-hmm.
that was right, that the information proved legit.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's no question about how the movie portrays it. It's just...
Well, I guess what should have been done, Sasha, in retrospect, is that they shouldn't have made the movie, because unless they can make a movie by at the same time roundly and passionately declare that torture is evil and that we are lesser people and we have denigrated our nation's tradition as a result, because they didn't say that clearly... There's a problem with this movie, and it doesn't deserve
it. No, that's not it. Like, look at The Hurt Locker. Okay, so we went into the war in Iraq, because supposedly there were weapons of mass destruction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody now believes that those never happened. Some people still believe that they did, right? It's a debate. If The Hurt Locker had been about finding those weapons of mass destruction...
Mm-hmm.
or anything like that, and telling that side of the story, it would be taking a very specific side. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, except that no one really believes that WMD has any merit at this point. Nobody.
Right, and so The Hurt Locker beautifully reflects